3.5 hours of civil rights on the streets in Santa Cruz. Stay with us.
Downtown, blaze, Russian roulette with you, that's right. I said downtown when you're brown on a Friday night, blaze, Russian roulette with you. But not with a second-hand Saturday night special, nah. Downtown, blaze, Russian roulette with a brand new SJPD revolver. One bullet for injustice, one bullet for intolerance, and one bullet for the self-hating sellout Latino capuleto that will never bust enough Mexicans, harass enough Chicanos, or beat the shit out of enough cholos to feel equal to his Caucasian counterparts. You see, downtown when you're brown, Officer Lopez is hunting down Chicanos like the Terminator, hoping in vain that one day he may be able to wake up and scrub the brown out of downtown, or at the very least, out of his own skin. Downtown! Downtown when you're brown, the muffled sound of injustice is drowned out by the boom, boom, boom of tricked out Impalas and cherried out many drugs, as the cat calls of oppression are heard up and down Santa Clara streets, and beautiful Latinos cut five or six deep in midnight blue Buick Rivieras with gold smokes and silver crucifixes hanging from rear mirror. Downtown when you're brown on a Friday night, all the signs say no cruising zone, but what they really mean is no fucking Mexican zone. Because SJPD will pull you over for being downtown and brown, and for no other reason, and you will find yourself on the corner of 27th and Santa Clara at a McDonald's parking lot, surrounded by four police cruisers, while two bigs in SWAT gear search your car illegally, and a third one frisks you. And now I'm not talking about no pussy little frisk like you see in front of a club. I'm talking about a real motherfucking frisk like they do on cops, where they tell you to spread your legs, put your hands on the hood of the car, and they pat you down so good you think you're getting a hand job. And you know, if they don't find nothing on you, if they don't find nothing on you,
and welcome to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Civil Rights on the Streets, twice a week show I do here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. You're invited to join me. Call-in lines are open. We only have one of them, and we'll be having a guest in about 15 minutes. We'll be taking up about 45 minutes of those lines, but that leaves another 2.5 hours or more for you to jump on board. Plus, we have little time before that happens. So let me give you the number, and for those of you who don't already have it, it's pretty easy to remember. It's 427-3772, 427-FRSC, for the direct line into the studio. We don't censor calls here. I may get a little impatient if you're talking about things that have no interest at all for me, but hey, give it a try. I'm pretty open. We got a lot of time, and other things coming up are an election. We're hoping to bag activist Scott Graham here to give his analysis of the election ticket coming up. I should say the various tickets proposed, propositions from the state and city level. Everyone, or some folks out there certainly, will be voting on Tuesday. I'll be dumping my absentee ballot off on the, I guess it's the second or third floor of the county building sometime before Tuesday. I think you can actually do it on Tuesday, but I'm not sure. But certainly you can do it before Tuesday. You have some choices coming up for the supervisorial race of the 3rd District. Those of you who live in the 3rd District, which is most of Santa Cruz, that includes a three-cornered race between Marty Wormhout, incumbent supervisor, Mark Premack, incumbent city council member, and Michael Schmidt, incumbent activist. And, of course, people who have been listening to the show know my thoughts on that. Schmidt, because of his accessibility generally, because of his ability to educate the community on unpopular cutting-edge issues like homeless civil rights and the need to sleep at night for homeless people. Schmidt, because of his willingness to grow personally in spite of his past position, which has not been good on homeless issues, but once he was acquainted with the facts, not only did he learn from them, but he taught others. And to me, that speaks well for him and for certainly giving him a chance in this primary. I mean, maybe it probably will be. No one's going to win this primary. It'll be a reduce it to two people running, although if one person gets more than 50% of the votes, I guess that would settle it. But there'll be two people running for the next 6 months into the November election, at which point there'll be a decision for the 3rd District Supervisor. And we'll be talking about those races. You can call in and talk about that. Also, we have been down south. I've been down south with activist Becky Johnson, who had a court case in Los Angeles, which I think she may be calling in to talk about. She was hit by the LAPD about a year and a half ago at the Democratic National Convention, along with a bunch of other people, where police particularly targeted reporters and video journalists, and Becky had a camera, although it has to be said the people around her were hit and they didn't have cameras, so the police are equal opportunity abusers, and that's always good to know, or perhaps not so good to know, or I guess you should know it, but you shouldn't applaud it. Anyway, she went down to for a settlement conference, which she may be talking about, where a preparatory to a trial, and as I understand it, that settlement conference, various amounts of money were offered on both sides. There was no agreement reached, and so there will be a trial in federal court for civil rights violations for Becky seeking to recover money from the police, and the police seeking to assert the propriety of its behavior, that its actions did not rise to excessive force. And that, of course, is going to be an interesting case to follow, because who knows? The LAPD is one of the most out-of-control departments in the country, it looks like to me, in spite of all the focus with the Rampart station corruption spotlight, which has gotten on LAPD. There still is significantly no meaningful changes in the LAPD, as far as I can see, that would really rein in these not just rogue officers, but institutionalized code of blue silence, code of blue policies, where you have kind of a pack gang mentality supported by massive amounts of public funding, the apparent awareness of a huge national emergency, or the perception of a national emergency, something I would call an act of major hysteria. Major frenzy and fantasy, and also a political gain for those in power as they flex their muscles and beat their opponents over the head with the emergency. So we'll be following cases like that. There's also going to be a subject coming up in about 5 minutes of some interest to me, which I mentioned briefly. Mel Mason, who's a Seaside City Council member, or was, I should say, African-American activist, former Black Panther, a man who walks the talk. He came over to Santa Cruz a week ago when there was a march to free all political prisoners, particularly focusing on the imprisonment of Mumia Abu-Jamal on, I guess it's life in jail row, or is it death row? I'm not sure exactly where that case is right now. But in any case, one of the three or four people that Amnesty International has declared prisoners of conscience, or at least there were four of them about 5 years ago when I calculated, and I guess two of them have been released, and he's still in jail, so is Leonard Peltier. And Mason, anyway, came to town along with other activists from San Jose, spoke at the town clock, marched up Pacific Avenue. I was with them, sporting my bathrobe and my teddy bear as I went for the more local issue of the kinds of political, social, economic harassment that homeless people suffer under these cities' anti-homeless sleeping ban ordinance, the municipal code that criminalizes poor people outside, just simply for falling asleep or covering up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night in a city that has shelter facilities for less than 10% of the homeless population in the winter and less than 5% in the summer, yet still expects them all to hide out or get out. And the infamous former council member Rotkin's proposal, he didn't use those words, but that's the substance of what he would say. And even though we heard some good rhetoric against it from current sitting council members, we've seen nothing but rhetoric, and actually bad rhetoric in the last few years. Anyway, Mason came to town on Saturday a week ago and spoke, and we went to Yuppie Planter, as I now call the Pacific and Lincoln Street area, Soquel and Lincoln Street area, where Sushi Now and Alibaba's Cafe have privatized the sidewalk with the collusion and assistance of the Relocation Agency and the City Council, and in the silence of New Leaf Market, the oh-so-politically correct eatery and grocery store sitting on the corner there, silently covering its eyes, covering its ears, covering its nose, and covering its mouth, and saying nothing, as two private entrepreneurs are used as cat's paws to drive away the youth scene, which has largely been done. I was gone the last few days, as I said, in the South, but I did notice when I was here earlier this week, not only has the green fence been set up that privatizes the Planter area, which had been a community planter and a community area, but the police apparently are also driving people away from the edges of that area. You can't sit, not only can you not sit within the forbidden fenced-in private zone that is now the preserve of Sushi Now and Alibaba's Cafe's friends and patrons, but you also can't sit 10 feet from any of those areas. So the message is clear. Move on, you hippie types. Move on, you grubby people. Move on, you skateboarders, you hacky sackers. Go somewhere else. We don't want you here. And it has been said, well, that's only one spot. Poor Matisse Selman of Sushi Now, poor Ali Ka of Alibaba's Cafe, with the kinds of problems they had with their clientele. The occasional hacky sack would come into their restaurant area. You'd get people feeding the pigeons at the Planter, which Matisse Selman's father would then call the police on those folks and give them tickets for littering. You'd have individuals playing guitars, and that would upset Ali Ka because he had his own amplified music, which he wanted to run on the area, or his own musician that he would have sitting there playing without a permit, of course, but still playing in his cafe, sometimes amplified music. But cafe owners, don't you know, are, you know, somewhat higher class than those folks who sit at the Planter, and therefore they have the right to monopolize the sidewalk. And they, in fact, got the Redevelopment Agency through Cecil Cirillo and the City Council through Chris Crone to get this whole thing passed and privatized. And that's been done just in time for the opening of the Del Mar Theater so that all the patrons don't have to spend a lot of time witnessing the unsightly demeanor and the clustery youth nature of the youth out there who we have heard reportedly have been engaging in threats of harassment and harassing women and things of this sort, some of which, you know, I have no doubt is true, although I've spent a lot of time down there and I don't see that much of it, certainly not as much as you would see in any group of that size that gathers, particularly in a regular way downtown. I guess the idea is to eliminate all groups gathering downtown so that only the shoppers can sort of march through and drop their funds and then leave. I've been through this a lot of times, so I don't really need to belabor the point, though I will be playing some sort of updated tapes later on in the show, and I do invite your comments. Again, the call-in number here at Free Radio is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. We also stream on the net, in case you want to know, www.microradio.net/FRSC. Again, for Free Radio Santa Cruz. And we go out across the country and across the world, and hopefully we're having some listeners down in Southern California today because, as I said, I just got back from there where I was unsuccessful in actually visiting the Isla Vista encampment, which sort of a camp paradise type situation. Folks have set up a camp and been in a tent city for the last month and a half there.
similar to Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon, similar to Tent City 3 in Seattle, Washington, or perhaps Camp Goodwill in Toronto, Ontario, where homeless people themselves have peacefully and in a fairly regulated and drug-free manner taken things into their own hands and said, look, we have to camp somewhere, we have to sleep somewhere, let's do so in a way we can do so with the maximum protection and civil order and appropriate self-governance, and it seems to me a good idea. I've gotten only, again, secondhand reports on what's going on down there, and you yourself heard Jenny Jett talk about that issue a couple weeks ago on Free Radio. And if you want more information about this, or actually anything else on this general subject of civil rights for the homeless, you can always give a call off-air, in case you're a bit shy about going on-air, or perhaps you just don't catch the show at the right time. 423-HUFF, 423-H-U-F-F. HUFF is acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's an organization concerned with civil rights for the homeless. I've been at the center of it for the last 12 years. We have meetings every Wednesday at Baker Square, a restaurant on Ocean Street at 1107 Ocean at 8:30 a.m. in the morning. Folks are invited to come on in. You haven't got money for coffee? We'll put out for coffee and look to find out what's going on out there. Also, there's a Homes on Wheels actually has an active chapter down in Santa Barbara. I may be talking about that a little later in the show. We have a kind of a ghost chapter here in Santa Cruz. Haven't heard much from the Homes on Wheels folks, although there are plenty of people sleeping in their vehicles out there, people still being harassed by police for simply doing what they need to do, not necessarily for any, you know, health and safety violations. And I'm always sympathetic to neighbors and police if they have genuine health and safety concerns, and those are real concerns, and those are the things we should really be talking about, not whether a person should be allowed to sleep legally somewhere, which really is a kind of a non-issue. It's going to happen whether you like it or not. The question is, what's the best way to manage it so that folks are not treated like second-class citizens, so that the property is not trashed, so that health and safety is preserved? And that was actually brought up some time ago by Councilmember Keith Sugar, of all people, back in his liberal days when he was just elected to city council. He was an environmental attorney who had come into power with council members Fitzmaurice and Crone in a kind of a landslide, significantly heavy vote in their favor against the conservative Scott Kennedy supported pro-development, pro-beach boardwalk deal, pro-downtown association candidates, Linda Steino, Rod Quartararo, and Jane, is it Walden? Not quite sure of that. But in any case, Sugar came in and he had some great proposals. He actually stood up somewhat ill-prepared because he found it difficult to meet and talk with activists, but he actually managed to meet with several groups of activists in those early days and proposed that the sleeping ban be suspended over the winter of 1998-99 unless there were some kind of a real health and safety concern. And, of course, Fitzmaurice, showing his colors early, I suppose some would say not green, but yellow-green, but it's not, I don't know if it's really yellow. I don't think Fitzmaurice is a coward. I think he's just a very conservative, sort of a Republican-type character on these social issues who takes his cues from conservative neighborhood associations rather than the basic human need requirements that we all have, even the poorest of us, even those who are homeless. Even those who are homeless and somewhat unsightly, and even those who are somewhat unsightly and homeless and don't have the best behavior. Punish the bad behavior, but don't punish behavior that's necessary, like sleeping, like the need to shelter and cover up. You can't do that without becoming, you know, without crossing the line into violating basic Judeo-Christian principles, principles that international and national organizations have held that are sort of at the core of human rights for a long time. You don't even have to get into the right to housing. It's just the right to be left alone if you don't have housing. You cannot criminalize people for natural bodily functions if they have no other choices. To do so is really a form of cruel and unusual punishment, even though the Supreme Court has ruled that you can only have the cruel and unusual punishment after you're convicted. There still is such a concept as real cruel and unusual punishment before that happens, and that's really what it is, even though we can't pull out the Eighth Amendment and strike it out. Thank you, Rehnquist Court. And a thank you, California Supreme Court as well, unfortunately. Anyway, I'm hoping to get a call from Mel Mason. I don't know if he's having trouble reaching us. He did have trouble last week. His idea, as he expressed it to me a week ago, or actually almost 2 weeks ago now, when we last spoke, he talked about how police review boards, such as the Santa Cruz Citizens Police Review Board, even the Berkeley Police Review Commission, are generally toothless and hobbled by all kinds of, particularly in California, restrictions imposed by strong police officers' unions, timid politicians, don't-rock-the-boat bureaucrats. In Santa Cruz, for instance, if you have a serious police complaint about, let's say, a police officer beating you up, if you're filing a civil claim, it'll never get to the police review board, because the city council will stop it pending the disposition of the claim, which could take several years. So these police officers who are beating people up, unless the Internal Affairs Department of the police does its own analysis and takes its own action, and of course we can always trust the police to police themselves, right, then the officers will continue to walk around doing just what they did. Unless, you know, we had a Rodney King situation where people were videotaped doing this stuff, you know, or there's a someone who blows the whistle, like in the Rampart scandal down in Los Angeles. And even there, cases are getting thrown out, cases are getting blocked. There is no longer the kind of impetus to deal with and purge the department that initially seemed to be happening several years ago in that situation. So, because the city government agencies and the state government agencies and certainly the federal government agencies, who are supposed to be concerned with civil rights, but often, as we found in the 60s, were on the side of the Klan and were giving them information about the civil rights protesters, the community needs to take action. The community needs to step in and do the work that the elected representatives will not do and the appointed representatives will not do. And that's what Mel Mason was talking about doing in Seaside, having a real community review tribunal, where not only would there be ample opportunity, as I understand it, for police to confront their accusers, and that could be Mel calling in right now, but opportunity to publicize, have witnesses speak, and even pursue a citizen prosecution.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, hi, Robert. This is Mel.
Uh-huh. We're hey, just talking about you, Mel.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just saying that you are, we're talking with Mel Mason. He's on the line with us. We finally bagged you, and I appreciate your trying to reach us last week, and sorry you couldn't get in.
Uh-huh.
You are a person who's, want to give us a little bit of your history around concerns with the police department, how those concerns first arose, both at Seaside and then, you know, more generally?
Okay, well, it actually goes back to 1968.
Let me get you to speak up a little bit.
Yeah, it actually goes back to 1968 when I joined the Black Panther Party. And I think, as most people know, that the Black Panther Party was actually formed initially in response to police brutality in African-American communities. And from there, throughout the years, I have been involved, especially around here in my hometown of Seaside and actually throughout Monterey County, in numerous efforts over the decades of dealing with police abuse, police misconduct, and police brutality in African-American and other communities of color. In 1998, the Seaside Police killed a friend of mine by the name of Charles Vaughn Sr. We are still, you know, dealing with that matter, even though the city settled out of court with the Vaughn children. We, you know, have been and continue to be pressing for prosecution for those police officers. They have been pretty much let off the hook by the district attorney's office, which found the killing supposedly justifiable in the face of all evidence that showed that it wasn't. And the Justice Department itself has said that the Seaside Police Department, while they felt that there was some wrongdoing, quote-unquote,
talking to you about this about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, where your concern was a sort of a mental health task force that was going to try to impose standards, because Charles Vaughn was a man with a mental health diagnosis.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And he was a retired school teacher and who had developed schizophrenia in the latter part of his life. And on the day that he was killed, I mean, there was actually a collaboration, if you want to call it that, between mental health, who wanted him hospitalized against his will because he had basically fired his case manager and had said that he no longer wanted mental health service. I saw Charles all the time, and at no time was he ever floridly psychotic or even showing any symptoms of his illness. He was living alone here in the community, had friends and family around. There was absolutely no justification for mental health to try to do that to him. But I think that this was done, you know, almost in retaliation for the fact that he had the wherewithal to go down and say, you know, thanks but no thanks, I don't need you guys' services anymore. The organization or an agency called Protection and Advocacy, Inc., out of Sacramento, which has the responsibility of investigating alleged violations of the rights of people with disabilities, came in and did their own investigation, and in their report found that both the Seaside Police Department and Mental Health were responsible for the actually criminally responsible for the death of Charles Vaughn Sr.
Now, was a lawsuit ever undertaken by his relatives or friends?
Right. The four adult children, filed a lawsuit against both the County of Monterey, through, you know, for its mental, you know, for mental health division's culpability in this, and also against the City of Seaside. City and county eventually ended up settling out of court with the children. But the part that we, you know, are still trying to press for is the prosecution of these police officers, especially in light of the Protection and Advocacy Incorporated report that, among other things, stated that neither mental health nor the police department should have ever even been on Charles's property that day. No less having orchestrated events so that they ended up shooting him to death.
Was there any agreement regarding, you know, guidelines in that settlement that the relatives got with the City of Seaside? Was it just a financial settlement, or was there some other agreement about, you know, training the police department or respecting people and curbing mental health, that sort of thing?
Right. Well, in the suit, the only aside from the financial settlement, they had agreed to erect some sort of
Still there? Hello? Looks like sounds like another line or something.
Hey, Daddy.
Thanks.
You can't hear your brother?
Yeah, we must have crossed four or something. I don't know what that
is. Try calling in again.
It looks like it was cut.
Are you still there?
Well, this is really wild. That's just the FBI.
Yeah.
Wow.
Some new way of disrupting black activist discussion. So maybe it's gone now.
Or
okay,
could,
are you still there?
Could be Sunday morning incompetence from Pac Bell. Who knows?
And it could be well that too. But they had also agreed to erect some sort of a memorial to Charles Vaughn's memory, because the man was had been a community leader, was a real activist, both a union activist, civil rights activist, as well as an outstanding educator. So we always, felt that it was real interesting that they killed somebody, they said it was justified, and then they agreed to erect a memorial to a person that they killed. Memorial still hasn't happened yet, and so that's another part.
Because a real memorial would be some kind of change in the rules,
right.
So that...
Well, we formed an organization called the Charles Senior Mental Health Police Practices Task Force, which those changes that you're talking about were actually brought about through
I think you're breaking up there, Mel. It sounds like somebody else's line is somehow interfering. Are you in a cellular or?
Well, I'm on a regular phone here at home, but, you know, it's a mobile phone. I mean, one, you know, doesn't have a card on it.
Huh.
So it's interesting that we're getting this interference. But anyway, we had, in addition to calling for the prosecution of the police, we had also called for the establishment of a crisis team. A crisis intervention team academy.
Mm-hmm.
There were such agencies in other parts of the country, and we've using a couple of those in Memphis and Albuquerque as some sort of model to work from for this county. We were told that this would not be done here, that it was not feasible, that our demands were unrealistic. We had met with numerous officials from the county, including the elected Board of Supervisors, the Mental Health Commission for the county. We met with the Director of Mental Health, Bob Agnew, who's I feel is a real incompetent person, and he finally retired, I understand, a few months ago. So that's maybe a big plus for mental health.
We're talking with Mel Mason. Mel, maybe what you can do is give a very brief description of how Charles Vaughn was killed, the man whose death precipitated this real concern with bad process in the Seaside Police Department and the mental health agencies there.
Right. Well, as I pointed out, on one day, Charles went down to the mental health department, and he basically was tired of the incompetence. In terms of the services that he was receiving, he felt that his caseworkers were incompetent, that he felt like he wasn't getting any kind of assistance from them. And at that time, he basically had his illness under control. He was living on his own in the community, and he just felt like he didn't need to be bothered with them anymore. So he went down, and he politely and respectfully told them that he didn't need the services anymore. Unbeknownst to me, at that particular point in time, there was apparently a meeting called in mental health, and they were saying, well, what this means is that he's probably, either gravely disabled or he's suicidal or something. We need to get him hospitalized. All of this came out later in the Protection and Advocacy Inc. report. On the night before he was killed,
had Charles attempted suicide any other time?
No, he had never attempted suicide. Had no history of violence.
Had he been unable to provide for his food and shelter?
No, he had his place. He had his shelter. He had friends. He had friends like me around. If he ever needed any kind of help at all, he could have called any of us, and he never did, because I was seeing Charles almost every day. We would talk a lot, he was never in any kind of condition like they were trying to describe.
And Charles was an African-American individual? Sounds like someone's trying to dial out there. Go ahead. He's still there?
Okay, maybe we're still. God, this is really. You know, this has never happened to my phone before, so I'm.
Well, you seen
some real difficulty understanding why this is going on.
Hmm.
But yes, Charles was African American. At the time he was killed, he was 60 years old. He's 5 years older than me. He and I had been friends since I was 16 years old, and I'm also the godfather for the two youngest of his four children.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, where were we?
You were telling me why he was killed.
Yeah, on the evening before he was killed, somebody had apparently seen him down in Monterey, which is, you know, the city next door to us, and he was just down there, either shopping or something, and somebody from mental health called the Monterey Police. The Monterey Police Department knew Chuck because he's lived here, you know, a big time. they actually saw him on the street. Yeah, hello?
Still here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they saw him on the street, and they, stopped.
Oh, talking. Bat River? My bathing suit under the clothes?
Sounds like you got a second phone call coming in here.
But I don't know what's going on here. Okay.
Go ahead.
And the Monterey police had stopped Charles. They talked with him. They called mental health, and they said, we're not taking the guy to the hospital because there's nothing wrong with him. You know, he's clear. He's lucid. He's not psychotic. We had a great conversation, and he went on about his business. The next morning, they called the Seaside Police Department. But this time what they did was they said that we need to hospitalize Mr. Vaughn. You know, we think that he's, possibly suicidal. He's gravely disabled. He's psychotic, and we need to get him into the hospital. And we have to be careful because he has a history of violence.
Which wasn't true.
Well, he had no history of violence, which they eventually had to admit. So you can imagine the mindset that the police had when they went to get him. They went there. The mental health workers showed up there. They knocked on the door, and all Chuck said was, could you just please leave me alone? He was sitting in his living room watching television. One of the police officers that had been harassing Charles, as I found out later, for over a year, beat on the door and started screaming at him to come out.
What was the name of this police officer?
His name is Lumpkin.
Is he still on the force?
Yeah, he's still on the force, and the other two people who actually shot him, two officers named Ron Guth and Joseph Britannia, those two guys are still on the police force. Guth has been promoted to sergeant. Britannia has a reputation for being a coke abuser. People have seen him sitting in his car, snorting cocaine while he's on duty. I have reported this, and apparently nothing was ever done. Well, obviously nothing was ever done. He has a number of complaints from citizens for police abuse. He was involved in the death of another African American person with mental illness back in 1991, but here in Seaside, in which he came into the house with a squad of police officers, chased this poor guy around the house, and slammed him to the floor, and the guy died from a heart attack. His name was Albert Macklin.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the individuals.
Was any money recovered in any civil lawsuit in that case?
I don't know. What I picked up from the grapevine was that the city supposedly settled with Mr. and Mrs. Macklin, who were quite old, for something like $20,000. And then they were told and threatened, supposedly, by the police. And when Chuck got killed, we tried to get some of these families of people who had been killed before to come out, and they, wouldn't, nor would any of the younger members of that family, because apparently they were afraid of the police.
Which actually led you to be involved in the Stolen Lives Project, which involved police murders throughout the country, and I guess that I haven't heard much from them, although I know that they came to Santa Cruz 4 years ago, and we actually had some support from council members Crone and Sugar before they disappeared behind the blue wall of silence,
right,
here in Santa Cruz.
Absolutely.
But you were telling me again the story of they came to Charles Vaughn Sr.'s house.
And basically, Lumpkin started beating and beating on the door in such a way that I'm sure that Chuck thought that they were breaking in his place. So he ran out of the back of his apartment. He grabbed a corkscrew, and he was yelling at them not, to leave him alone. They came around the back. They chased him up onto the roof of the apartment building. Chuck was just sitting there. Now, even if he was dangerous, even if he was dangerous, then he would no longer be dangerous at that point. Lumpkin decides to go up on the roof and get him. He goes over to him. He and Charles have words, and Lumpkin pulls out his mace, pepper spray, and starts to spray him. And he sprayed him until the thing was empty. And Chuck was yelling at him, don't do that to me, man. Don't do that to me, man. And then Lumpkin goes down off the roof, comes out to the two police officers who are on the ground, tells one of them, I'm going to borrow your can of pepper spray. And I'm going to go back up on the roof. And this is all in the DA's report plus the Protection and Advocacy Inc. report. I'm going to go back up on the roof, says Lumpkin, and I'm going to spray him again. And if he comes towards me, cap him, quote unquote.
Cap him means kill him.
Cap him means, it means kill him, shoot him and kill him. So Lumpkin goes up on the roof. Charles tells him, you know, Lumpkin, don't bother me anymore. You know, don't spray me anymore, man. I wouldn't do that. And so Lumpkin begins to spray him, and supposedly Chuck stepped forward because he had this little corkscrew. And then that's when Lumpkin then jumps out of the way so that these guys could then blow Charles away.
Which they did.
Which they did. They killed, they shot him and killed him, and he apparently was dead, you know, on the roof.
Was there a racial aspect to this? I mean, were the officers African American?
Well, Lumpkin is African American. The other two officers are white. One of the officers did mention the fact that Chuck was a big black man. He had seen him around and was afraid of him, he said. You know, well, Chuck had never done anything to the police. He had never done anything to anybody. But what was significant in this statement from this white officer was that he knew he was dealing with a big black man that he was afraid of. Okay? Lumpkin had his own personal problems. He had some problems with Charles Jr. Because apparently in high school he was quite jealous of Charles. Charles was a football star like his dad was in college. Lumpkin wasn't. Charles was a very popular. Charles Jr. was very popular. Lumpkin wasn't. In fact, Charles Jr. related to me that he was the one that actually introduced Lumpkin to, you know, the woman who later became Lumpkin's wife. But he never knew until in later years that Lumpkin had harbored this kind of resentment against him and his dad.
Lumpkin still is a, he was promoted, do you say? Right, or
yeah, Lumpkin is now an officer with the Seaside Police Department now. He went from being a sergeant to a lieutenant. These guys got promoted.
Any cases since then in the last, this happened in 98, right?
Yeah, this happened in 98, and but I think what happened was that, you know, we certainly haven't had any more shootings. I'm not saying that we haven't had any police abuse, because we're still continuing to deal with complaints of police brutality from people in this community, especially African Americans, and so we're constantly dealing with that.
And Seaside has a large African American community, right?
Right. Well, it has the largest African American community between San Jose and Los Angeles. So
Seaside's what, about 30,000 people, or?
Yeah, well, see, we have there's probably we have our population right now is about 30,000, and so we make up probably somewhere between around 20% of that population. And the population has decreased over the years. We used to have a lot more. Mm-hmm. We also have other, you know, African Americans living in other parts of the other parts of this county as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Seaside really has always had the biggest the largest number of African Americans living here.
So the response to the Protection and Advocacy Report, as well as I guess you don't have anything like a Citizens Police Review Board or anything in Seaside.
No. And I think what's significant is that we have a number of people who, and including myself, who said that we don't have one. We think that a real police review board would be one in which there would be subpoena power, prosecutorial power, and the ability to discipline. All of those powers would need to be inherent in a real police review board, and I don't know of any review boards anywhere around here that has such powers.
There was one, I think, Midwest, I think, had one.
Pardon me?
I think there's one in Minnesota.
Yeah.
But again, it may be connected with the police department itself. Often they have greater powers, but they're, you know, less accessible to the citizenry.
Right, absolutely. But we are in the process now of forming an ad hoc police review board. And this is going to be like a community tribunal organization. And what we're going to do is we're going to take complaints. You know, those of us who came together to form the Charles Bond Task Force, going to come together, and we're going to hold hearings, and we're going to use that kind of format to put pressure on all levels of government here in this county, from municipal to the county. this is not outlandish to demand, because in 1999, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission said that for communities that have had histories of police brutality, that these are the kinds of police commissions that need to be set up.
What kind of response have you gotten from the community and from the media?
Well, the media has been silent. The community has been, I think, wholeheartedly behind our efforts. They're looking at this as a first step towards getting some real justice around dealing with police brutality.
And how long have you been, I first heard about this project a couple weeks ago, I guess maybe a month ago. How far into this project are you, and how many folks are involved?
There's probably about 30 people involved at this point. You know, we have folks from organizations like the NAACP, MAPA, you know, Mexican American Professional Association. We have both chapters, Monterey and Salinas chapters of the League of United Latin American Citizens, the National Lawyers Guild chapter here, the ACLU chapter here, and an organization called Coalition of Minority Organizations as well. So those are the organizational formations that we have. And then we just have independent citizens, people who don't belong to any organization at all, but who see the need for this effort.
How are you going about organizing this? I know in Santa Cruz, an organization called SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network, started the Citizens Police Review Board movement. Well, actually, it was started independently as SCAN, but they picked up on it back in 1990-91 when, Sergeant Butchie Baker, then Officer Butchie Baker, was accused by first three and more women of sexual misconduct, and the police department's response was to promote him after declaring him Officer of the Year and clear him of all these charges. City Council initially formed an investigating committee, which was then dispersed under the initiation, I understand, of City Manager for Life, Dick Wilson. I call him City Manager for Life not because he actually was elected for life, because he is de facto City Manager for Life until he decides to resign. He's the real power in our city. Mayors may come and go. City councilmen do their little shtick and then move off the stage, but Wilson remains.
Mm-hmm.
But the initial impetus was this organization's, a number of organizations, but SCAN was one of them. It's the organization that's elected all